nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So, I guess at the beginning of the course, if you remember, we started by saying that for current voltage characteristics, you need this density of states. And once you have the density of states, you could calculate the current or the number of electrons inside a device given that information. Now, what we have been talking about the last, almost all of October is, in a way, some theoretical models that people use to calculate this density of states. So I guess the starting point usually is the Schrodinger equation, all that. And we went through this discussion of how from all that you usually get a EK relationship. And this EK relationship in general can be fairly complicated over the entire K space. But what you do is look around some special points, the ones that are closest to the chemical potential, what you call the valleys. And around those points, you might have some simple relationship, say something like this, epsilon k equals h bar square k square over 2m. So some simple relationship like this, right around one of those special points, which you call the valleys. And from this, then, you can relatively simply try to come up with a density of states, which you could use in the original equations. Now, there's another important conceptual thing that comes out of an EK relationship, which we didn't quite have back in September. And that is the idea that you not only have a bunch of states here, but you could also classify them in two groups. One group that carries current in one direction, and the other group that carries current in the opposite directions. And these two groups, once you have a special direction like that, say the X, you'll call this the X direction. When you have a device where you're interested in current flow in the X direction, it is useful to define a quantity called the number of modes, which is like this density of states, except that it is weighted by the velocity of the electrons. And this velocity, and this is what requires some discussion that we went through, this what's called the group velocity. This is like if you had an electron in that state, that's the speed with which it will be moving along x. And it's given by the slope of the EK relationship. So for example, if you have a E versus K looking like this, that's like a parabola, then if you looked at the velocity that you'd associate with that, it would be the slope of that, which would be like a straight line. So this would be like the velocity that you'd associate, because that's the slope of the parabola. So for positive k's, you have positive velocities. Negative k's, you have negative velocities. And so the idea is that any energy, when you look at the density of states, it's as if you got these two groups of states. One group which carries current in plus x direction, another group which carries current in the negative x direction. Okay? And the other important conceptual thing that we kind of went through from when going from what we're doing in September to where we are now is this idea of ballistic transport. So what I mean is, when we started back in September, the idea was, you have a density of states, and these electrons can go in and out at some rate determined by gamma 1 and gamma 2. And accordingly, we wrote this equation for the current. And in the special case, if you put gamma 1 equal to gamma 2, that's what it would amount to, this equation. Similarly, for the number of electrons, the occupation is this F1 and F2 weighted by gamma 1 and gamma 2. But then, if gamma 1 is equal to gamma 2, that amounts to saying that it's like F1 plus F2 over 2. So either you could say that all your states are occupied according to the average of the two Fermi functions, or you could say that half the states are occupied according to F1 and the half are occupied according to F2 in this view. Now, ballistic transport is related to a somewhat different transport regime, where what we are saying is we have a device that's fairly long, so tens of nanometers, 100 nanometers, fairly long, and you have very good contacts so that the electron can empty out here very easily. And then the point is that this gamma, which is related to how easily electrons get in and out of the contacts, that gamma is not determined so much by what happens here or here, but is really determined by how long the electron takes to get through this thing. That's the determining time, really. And so the gamma here can be replaced with h bar Vx over L, because the time it takes to get through your channel is L divided by Vx. That's the escape time. H bar divided by the escape time, that's the gamma. That's one way to think about it. And then you see the quantity you have here is essentially what we have called M, this number of modes. And in this class, actually, when we went through this discussion, we said, well, let's assume all these states are occupied according to F1, and all these states are occupied according to F2. What do you get for the current? And the expression we got was something like this, M. It's a totally different discussion, but the way you could connect it back to what we were doing in September would be to say it's really the same formula. It's just that gamma is now determined by how fast you get through the channel rather than by how fast you get out of the channel. That's it. Okay. So in that sense, we are making a transition from this molecular regime of transport, where your device is so short that all that matters is how fast you get in and out of it, and this ballistic regime of transport, where the contacts are really good. It's easy to get in and out of the channel. What really takes time is to get through the channel. Yeah.
So for the ballistic transport, both destructive states and gamma determined by EK leaderships.
When you have the molecular regime really small, you wouldn't talk about an EK relationship anymore, because EK relationship kind of implies a relatively big device. So if you just have a hydrogen molecule, there's really no EK relation for that. But you just have states.
For ballistic transport, we also talk for big devices.
Big meaning big enough that you could talk about an EK relation. So let's say hundreds of atoms long, but not millions of atoms long, in which case you have to bring in scattering, etc. And then you would be in the typical 305 regime, that would be the diffusive transport, right? Where electrons go through, I mean, not just straight through, but they kind of go along this highway for a while, then turn around, go this way for a while, and then go that way for a while, and so on. That would be diffusive transport. So you keep changing from the northbound to the southbound thing, and finally get there, but it takes you a whole lot longer. That would be the other regime of things, right? Which we haven't gone through. So in a way, there are these three regimes. You could say the molecular one, the ballistic one, and then the diffusive one. Right? And the thing is that conceptually, I'd say it's easier to understand it that way. In the molecular one is in a way the easiest one to understand. We did that in September, didn't need to know anything about EK diagrams. Ballistic one, it helps to know this EK diagrams and the idea that there are these two groups of states and all that. And the diffusive one, that's where we have to talk about scattering. And logically, it seems that's the way to understand it. It's just that historically, our understanding grew the other way. That's the thing. That till 1980s or so, every conductor that anybody made any measurements on was diffusive. 1980 to, say, 2000 or so, anything, people were looking at the ballistic regime and barely getting onto this molecular regime. And then I'd say in the last 10, 15 years, people have been making measurements on things as small as a hydrogen molecule. So historically, it's been the other way, which is why every place you read the way to start, everything's kind of the other way, except that once you know the whole thing, I think it makes much more sense to look at it from the bottom up. Okay. So those are the two things then that kind of enter this calculation of number of electrons or charge and the calculation of current. Electrons involves density of states, whereas current involves density of modes. The velocity is also involved because of the d gamma. That's always the case, right? Now, how would you calculate density of states? Well, that's where we now have a formula based on this EK relationships. And density of modes, it would be something like this. Now, roughly speaking, you can see how these will go by doing the following. So supposing we want the density of states in one dimension, then we have gone through this. So how does it work? When I do this in one dimension, and in general, whatever I'm discussing applies to any EK relationship, but just to be specific, we'll be thinking about this parabolic one. See, if you had it in two dimensions, it would have looked something like this. But for the moment, let's just assume we have something like this, but in one dimension. Okay. Now, my question is, how would you evaluate this sum again? If you remember, when you have go to big conductors, what do we do? Turn this summation into an integral. That's standard, right? So you do integral dk divided by 2 pi over L. And this integral of dk, that runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. And then there is the delta epsilon minus E. And this is where I think you could do this something. In order to turn the, what you want to do is turn this integral from dk into an integral of over d epsilon. And the way you could do it is, first step, put a 2 here and go from 0 to infinity. So you're only integrating over the positive k. And then, yeah, this is okay, I'll turn L over 2 pi, and then we'll write dk d epsilon, and then we'll write d epsilon delta epsilon minus E. And so this then becomes, like, this is a function of E. We could write this as a function of E, d epsilon integral delta epsilon minus E. So this would then become L over pi times whatever this quantity is at epsilon equal to E. So it would be like dk d epsilon evaluated at epsilon equal to E, which you could write as you see, velocity is like d epsilon dk. So dk d epsilon is like 1 over h bar v. So this amounts to L over pi h bar v e. So this is a useful thing to remember for 1D. That the thing is, what is the density of states in 1D? It goes exactly as the inverse of the velocity. Okay? This is something I've mentioned a few times, because this is an important thing to remember. And the velocity is like the slope of your EK diagram. So if the velocity is 0, the density of states there tends to blow up. And that's what we have discussed before. Okay. Now this is in one dimension. Now the question is, what would we get if this were in, say, two dimensions? Now this velocity here, by the way, is what power of the energy is this? Can you help me? Let's work this out. So supposing we have epsilon equals h bar square k square over 2m, then velocity is, can you help me? 1 over h bar dE dk. So how much is that? Please. H bar square k over m. So you can cancel that, h bar k over m. Now if I want to convert it back into energy, what would we get? And let's not worry about the constants. What I'm trying to figure right is, it is epsilon to the power what? And there's a bunch of constants here. But question is, it's energy to the power what? See, epsilon is proportional to k square. So k is square root of epsilon. So the velocity tends to go as the square root of epsilon if you have a parabolic relationship like this. Okay? So, and if you had actually worried about the constants and all that, I think you'd have got square root of 2 epsilon over m. That's what you'd have got. Which kind of amounts to saying energy is half mv squared? So that's another way of getting there. But the point is that velocity would go as e to the power a half. So what that means is that in 1D, then, the density of states in 1D would have gone as, you know, it's this L over pi h bar v. This is 1D. And that goes as e to the power, can you help me? E goes as constant times e to the power minus 1/2. And one can work out the constants. That's it. Now, what if I are doing this in 2D? So then you see again, I had to be starting from summation k, etc. But then when I turn the summation into an integral, I would have an integral over k dk d theta, divided by, you know, Lx over 2 pi, Ly over 2 pi, which is like S over 4 pi square. But again, I'm not worrying too much about constants. The important thing is instead of integral dk, I'd have k dk d theta. And then we'd have the delta epsilon minus E. So we could, and nothing in the integrand depends on d theta, so that's not a terribly important thing. It'll give you something here. I mean, it'll give you 2 pi in the end. I won't even worry about that. But the point I'm trying to make is, previously when we did this integral, we ended up with something that looked like e to the power minus a half. Now that I have an extra k, when I finish the integral, what will we have? E to the power? Yeah. You see, when I was doing the 1D integral, we had something like integral dk over L over 2 pi delta epsilon minus E. And we worked all this out and we got e to the power of minus half. Now that we are trying to do this integral here, we just got an extra k in there. But the k depends on energy though, right? How does it depend on energy? Well, we work this out. K goes as e to the power of half. So what should we get? Remember, with a delta, at the end of the day, what happens is the delta drops out and you just evaluate whatever's left at epsilon equals E. So here also, everything else will drop out and you'll evaluate the rest of it at epsilon equals E. And when you try to do that, you'll have an extra K sitting in there. And so that extra k will give you a extra e to the power plus a half. So in 2D, what happens is, when you get done, you get e to the power 0. 0 meaning a constant. That's what you find. In 2D, actually, if you work this out, in 2D, the density of states looks like, you know, when you plot the density of states in 2D for a k relationship that goes as a parabola, you'll get something like this. You know, there's of course a bottom of the band below which it goes to zero, but above that it's a constant. And that value, and this was one of your homework problems, is m over pi h bar square. If you include both spins, if you want to do it per spin, there'll be an extra 2 here. That's all. But this is m over pi h bar square times the area. Of course, in big devices, the density of states is always proportional to the size of the device. You double the area, you got twice as many states. Okay. But the point is, you get a constant. That's the important thing. And this is, again, in your homeworks. I'm sure you kind of went through the algebra, which is why I'm not going through it in detail. But what I'm trying to give you is a feeling for how you see what you get more easily, you know, without having to go through the entire math all the time. So I'm trying to show you, yeah, you see, in 1D you'll get this, in 2D you get this. Now the question is, what do you expect in 3D? Well, now you see what will happen is, when I try to do this integral, I'll write a k squared dk. Because, you know, in spherical coordinates, you have k squared dk sine theta d theta d phi. So you have a whole bunch of, you know, sine theta d phi. That's fine. But the important thing is a k squared dk. So now you have this extra k square. You know, compared to what you had in 1D, you got extra k square. And k square is like E. Again, because of this relationship, though. Everything could change if you didn't have a parabolic relation. You know, if you started from alpha k to the power 4, everything could have been different. And all this would have to be that part. You know, things in terms of k would be much the same. What would change, of course, is whenever you try to turn the k into e. That's when things would look a little different. Okay. But here, because k square goes as e then, what will happen is, relative to this, it will be like it's multiplied by e to the power 1. And so what will you get here? E to the power? Right. Minus half plus 1. So it's plus half. And that's the usual result. You see, in 3D, the density of states goes up as the square root of e. Something like that. 2D, it's constant. 1D actually, it blows up this way. So those are the answers. Now, what about the number of modes? You know, this was the density of states. Another interesting, important point is the number of modes. Again, you could write it out, but the thing is that the modes has an extra velocity in it. And velocities in this model go as square root of e. So basically, when you calculate the number of modes, what happens is you have a square root of e relative to this. So what ends up happening is, so that's the results for the density of states. But when you look at modes, this is e to the power 0, that's e to the power 1/2, and that's e to the power 1. You just pick up an extra square root of e. Now, what takes time is to figure out all the constants properly in front. But broadly, this is it. You know, this is the density of states that you tend to get. This is the modes that you tend to get. Now, so what would happen when you actually try to calculate the, say, current? You'd run up with integrals. Let me just take this off here. So as I said, you could call this quantity the number of modes. So what you'd have to do is an integral of m over a Fermi function, and then m over a different Fermi function. So when you actually try to evaluate currents or number of electrons, that's the kind of integral you'd generally have to do. And similarly, when you try to do the number of electrons, then again, you have to do again density of states times F1, that's one integral, density of states times F2, that's the other integral. Those are the two integrals you usually end up doing. So, and see, since these modes, density of states, all these things are usually e to the power something. you know, could be minus half, zero, half, etc. What you always end up doing is integrals of this type. Integral dE, e to the power something, I'll write a j. I guess that's, I hope there's no confusion with square root of minus 1 or anything. That's just an index, whatever it is. D of j. And then a Fermi function. You know, where mu is, you know, if it's f1, it would be mu1. If it's f2, it would be mu2. But you end up having to evaluate integrals of this type. You see? Which is why these are called the Fermi-Dirac integrals. And in dimensionless form, these are all tabulated. You can look it up. Actually, as it turns out, I think if j is equal to 0, then you can write it analytically. If j is anything else, half, minus half, 3 halves, then you have to look up a table. So, usually the way they write it is, they go to a dimensionless quantity, like instead of dE, they define something, let's say dE over kT. So, you'd have, so let's take E over kT and call it, say, T. You know, nothing to do with time or anything, just a dimensionless variable. So, when you're doing this integral, you turn it into integral dT, t to the power j divided by exponential t minus x plus 1. That way, these t's and x's are all dimensionless numbers. And that's the Fermi-Dirac integral. I think there's a constant in front that the definition involves, this gamma function, 1 over gamma j plus 1, probably, right? So, but this is what you can easily look up. And these days, of course, with Google, you know, it just takes a minute to find out exactly what it is. You just put in Fermi-Dirac integrals, you'll find what it is. It's all tabulated. Just look it up anytime. Okay. But here I'm just trying to mention to you that, in general, that's what you have to evaluate. Whatever the device is, you need to know this. If you are doing current, you'll have this number of modes. If you are doing number of electrons, you'll have density of states. But at the end of the day, all of those usually is e to the power something. And whatever that something, accordingly, you do the right integrals. Yeah.
The interesting thing here is that if you have one device, you have calculated all of these k relationships, density states. If this device is large, you have to, then this current, it's, you have to integrate over square root of phi. But if we decrease the device, if we increase the device, then this is, you have to integrate of power of 1.
By increase or decrease, you mean like where we are going from the molecular to the ballistic regime, right? Because then I'd say when you're really small, then instead of using m, even here you should be using d. Because if you remember, our original formula looked like pi d gamma. And for molecular things, the gamma is just determined by how good your contacts are. So what really enters here as the property of the channel itself is the density of states. Whereas once you get to relatively long things, then the gamma is a property of the channel, and this whole thing is then called M. So in that sense, there is a difference between what you should integrate when something's really small and when something's relatively big.
It's very interesting to see how increasing or decreasing the channel, you have taken different...
Right. And then when it gets even longer, that's when you have to worry about the scattering part of it. That's when you'd actually go over to Ohm's law. Because still the way this is, the current you get is independent of the length of this thing. You could make it longer, you still get the same current. It's just determined by how many modes you have. It doesn't depend on how long it is. So and number of modes depends on the width of the channel. So, you know, Ohm's law tells you that resistance should go as proportional to length and inversely as the width. What we calculate here goes inversely as the width. I mean, the conductance goes as the width because of modes. What it doesn't have is this length part of the story. And that comes from scattering. That requires it to go to the diffusive limit. Okay, so here I just wanted to make this point that when you do these integrals in general, you always end up with these Fermi-Dirac integrals. And that's why, you know, they have been tabulated, so you can easily look them up. And the only one that you can do without looking up, you know, which is analytical, is when j is equal to 0. That's when I think this just becomes a logarithmic function. Okay. Now, what I wanted to go through, though, is a simpler example where I don't really need to use the Fermi-Dirac integrals. And that is, what I'll assume is that the temperature is relatively low. So if the temperature is low, then you see this Fermi function can be viewed as a step function like this. See? And then there's lots of things you can do very quickly without using Fermi-Dirac integrals, don't have to go to anything. And that's what I wanted to go through, a simple example to illustrate that if you had a ballistic channel, how the ballistic conductance depends on the width. That's what I want to do. So that's what I'll kind of do for the rest of the class. So the way this goes is, let's think of a simple two-dimensional conductor. So I'll draw it here. Whose width is W, length, and the EK relationship, let us say, is parabolic. This is the x direction, that's the y direction. Now, in this case, if you actually calculate the density of states, what it comes out as, the density of states will come out as, and this was one of your homework problems, so you can look this up. It was this m over 2 pi h bar square. If you do not include spins, if you include the two spins, then you get twice the density of states. So if you looked at the density of states, it would sort of look like this. You know, starts at zero, and then you have a constant. So if you had to find the number of electrons, yes, please.
To calculate the density of state, we use the periodic boundary conditions. But if you go to small size devices, I mean, periodic boundary condition doesn't hold. So how does it, you know, how can we do that?
Right. So this is the point that I've mentioned a few times, that in general, these periodic boundary conditions are widely used. And of course, that again comes from this history where we are usually used to dealing with really big things. And there the argument is that the boundary conditions don't matter. We are talking about the electron density somewhere in the middle of a large conductor. Doesn't matter where the boundaries are. That's the usual argument.
We still work on the large.
Right. So when you get to small things, then you have to actually often worry about the boundary conditions. And in particular, density of states for small things may not even be uniform across the whole thing. You may have more states here and there. And that is something we'll talk about a little later, like next week or so, about local density of states and so on. But here I'd say that, as it turns out, if you actually had bad contact, so electrons can't get out very easily, then what would happen is the wave functions would have to go to zero here. And that would strongly change the density of states in here, if you really had a box like this. In practice, of course, you're trying to make very good contact, so electrons easily go out from here. And in that case, I'd say, as long as this is relatively long, what I mean is, I think the electron de Broglie wavelength in these, de Broglie wavelength meaning if you take this k and look at, think of it as 2 pi over lambda, then if you find the lambda, it would be about 100 angstroms or so. So as long as this is 1,000 angstroms or longer, probably there wouldn't be much of a noticeable difference in the density of states compared to the periodic one. But you're right. I mean, that in general, as it gets smaller, one should worry about those things. Okay. Now, yeah. So what we are using then is the density of states that really applies to an infinite solid, where what you have assumed is you got periodic boundary conditions around. So there are no edges. So what you find is really most applicable to right in the middle of things. And near the edges, if the edges are, you know, things could change somewhat near the edge. Okay, so this is the density of states. Now let us say we are at equilibrium and you have a chemical potential somewhere here. Yeah. That's the equilibrium one, it's a single one. Now my question is, what is the number of electrons? How do you find the number of electrons? In general, of course, integral dE, d of E times Fermi function. And this is equilibrium, so you have a single Fermi function. You could do this. Now, if you assume you are at very low temperatures, then what this amounts to is looking at how many states you have below mu. Why? Because at zero temperature, the Fermi function is one below this, it's zero above it. So you just fill it that much. So can you help me with what the number of electrons would be in that case? That's the density of states. And you're filling it up to mu, and we call this zero, zero of energy. So how much is it? Just this times n. Actually, the density of states is this times the area. Area meaning S equals WL. So this has the dimensions of per unit energy. And then if I multiply by mu, I'll get the number of electrons. So the number of electrons is just density of states times mu at zero temperature. Because you're just, in general, of course, to do this integral, I'd run into one of those Fermi Dirac integrals. You know, I'd have to look it up in general. But zero temperature, I could just do this. And n divided by s, that's what's usually called the electron density per unit area. So that's what is usually written as small ns. So in two dimensions, this would be a simple relation that relates the electron density to where the chemical potential is. So typical operating condition of transistors, you know, you have a two-dimensional conductor whose electron density is about 10 to the 12th or 10 to the 13th per square centimeter. That's the typical operating condition of a transistor in the on state. Okay. Now, next we want the conductance, let's say. So if you have a small voltage across it. Now, when you have a small voltage across it, then as I've mentioned before, at low temperatures, now you can take these two things as sharp functions so that F1 minus F2 looks something like this. So this is F1 minus F2. And if the number of modes is approximately constant in this range, then I could do this, Q over H times M at mu, pull this out, and then have integral dE F1 minus F2. And can you help me with how much this is? Remember, this minus that, so it's 1 here over an energy range of mu1 minus mu2. So when you do the, when you integrate it, you get that much, which is mu1 minus mu2, and that is equal to Q times the applied voltage. And so, you could write this as Q square over H times M of mu times V. And here, of course, since I included the spin here, possibly I should include the spin here also. I'll put a 2 there. So this would be a good expression. So, under these conditions, again, when the applied voltage you know, is small, so that the number of modes is almost constant, you could have a nice simple relationship like this. So you could write then the conductance, this is I. So if I want the conductance, it's I over V. So I could write the conductance as 2q squared over h times m of mu. Okay, now what is the number of modes as a function of energy? So let me write that here. So what is the number of modes as a function of energy? Now, again, to get the constants right takes a few minutes, but you know what power of E to expect. What is it? Remember, this is a two-dimensional conductor. The density of states was E to the power 0. It was a constant. So the number of modes should be E to the power 1/2. Because it's multiplied by velocity. So you expect this to go as e to the power 1/2. The question is, what do you multiply it by? And that's the part that I guess we had one of you, this you had in one of your homework problems. And the answer goes something like this, that it's like this is in two dimensions. As you know, if you I said that another way to think of the number of modes is how many of these subbands you have below that energy. How many subbands of, you could count the number of subbands. That's another way to get that answer. And if you look back, the answer we had actually is something like this. Square root of 2me over h bar times w over pi. And I guess the justification for that, the way you think about that is that, you know, it is sort of like how many subbands, that each one of these subbands represents the electron fitting into this box, like maybe with half a wavelength or full wavelength or three of them and so on. And so question is how many of them you can fit in. So in a way, for a given energy, this is the K that goes with it. And Kw over pi kind of tells you how many you can fit into this region. And this requires a little more discussion since I'm kind of running out of time. I'm glossing over it for the moment. But this particular relation, of course, you have seen before. This was like one of the homeworks anyway. So based on that then, if I use this here, what I'd get is 2q squared over h times m of mu. So it's like w over pi h bar times square root of 2m mu over h bar. Now what I'm trying to do is get a relationship between this conductance and this electron density. That's what I'm really up to. Because electron density depends on where the chemical potential is. Conductance also depends on where the chemical potential is, and I want to get rid of the chemical potential, so I have a direct relationship between conductance and electron density. That's what I'm really trying to do. And instead of conductance, let me write this as resistance, so that I could write resistance is equal to h over 2q squared pi h bar over w okay. And then what I can do is from here I could replace m mu with ns. and mu is pi h bar square ns. So this is just algebra to eliminate the mu in favor of ns. And then what you get is that the resistance times w. And remember, this is the resistance of a ballistic two-dimensional conductor. So you're talking about two-dimensional channel, transport is ballistic. So that resistance times the width of that channel is given by this. It's inversely proportional to square root of the electron density. So this h over 2q square, as you know, is, this is this quantum of resistance, I guess. And I think actually it's something like 13 kilo ohms or 12.9 kilo ohms. And then the square root of pi over 2 some factor. And ns, as I mentioned, let's say is about 10 to the 12th per square centimeter. So when you take its square root, you'll get something like times 10 to the power minus 6 centimeters. So when you multiply all that out, you'd get about 160 or so ohm microns. Okay. So what that tells you is that a ballistic conductor that is 1 micron wide, two-dimensional conductor, 1 micron wide ballistic conductor, would have a resistance of 160 ohms. And this 160 ohms is fundamental. The thing is, it doesn't matter how good your contacts are. You know, for a long time, of course, people have realized that if you make a conductor really small, then the important resistance is the contact resistances. It all comes from where you make your contacts. That people have realized that when you make it smaller, this resistance goes down, but then you have all this. But what was not realized before, say, 1990 or so, is that there is a fundamental limit to how low you can make that resistance. Because what this tells you is that even with the best of contacts, if this is a ballistic conductor and you have great contacts, the resistance would still be 160 ohms if it is 1 micron wide. And if it was a tenth of a micron wide, it would be 1600 ohms. Because that product will always be 160 ohm micron. See? And present day contact resistances, you know, are actually bigger than this. So it looks like in addition to the fundamental resistance, there's other parasitic resistances also. But the point to recognize is that even after you get rid of all the parasitics, there is this minimum resistance that you always will have. And that really comes from the fact that you always have to, you know, that there is always this resistance associated with even the best of contacts. And this is the point that caused enormous confusion back in the 1980s. That, you know, as I said, people used to debate about this, that when you make something ballistic, what resistance will you measure? And today the answer is known. What you'll measure is this h over 2q square times 1 over the number of modes, which depends on the electron density and all that. So for a single-moded thing, it amounts to 13 kilo ohms. But for a two-dimensional conductor with a parabolic, with an EK relation looking like that, it comes to, you know, we just went through what you get. And that comes to about 160 ohms for something 1 micron wide. So let me stop here today. And I guess Wednesday we'll have the second midterm. And then we'll continue again on Friday.